Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Syria's new interim prime minister says he wants to deliver basic services, resettle refugees, and start tackling other vast challenges facing an economy hollowed out by war, corruption, and sanctions under the Assad regime. But Syria's coffers are empty of foreign currency. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has more.
Long queues form at a Damascus bakery on Wednesday, one of many signs of Syria's critical economic problems. As the new interim prime minister, Mohamed al-Bashir, said he wanted to bring back millions of Syrian refugees and provide basic services, but would struggle to without foreign currency. Syria's coffers contain only local pounds worth barely anything, Bashir told Italian newspaper Il Corriere della Sera. Bashir ran a rebel-led government in a tiny pocket of northwestern Syria before the 12-day rebel offensive toppled President Bashar al-Assad. In the capital, banks have reopened, as have shops, and there are fewer armed men about. But rebuilding Syria will be a colossal task, following a civil war that killed hundreds of thousands of people. International sanctions on the Assad regime have also gutted the economy. Two senior U.S. congressmen, a Republican and a Democrat, wrote a letter calling for Washington to suspend some sanctions on Syria. The most punishing ones are up for renewal this month, and the former rebels have told Reuters they are in touch with Washington about potentially easing them. Basil Hamwi, head of the Damascus Chambers of Commerce, told Reuters the new government has told business leaders it will adopt a free market model after decades of state control and integrate Syria into the global financial system.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. This is VOA News. U.S. officials say Russia might again launch its lethal new intermediate-range ballistic missile against Ukraine soon. Pentagon spokeswoman Sabrina Singh cited a U.S. intelligence assessment on Wednesday.
It's possible that Russia could do it in the coming days. I don't have an exact date for you. I think it's important to note that should Russia choose to launch this type of missile, it's not going to be a game changer on the battlefield. It's just yet another attempt to inflict harm and casualties in Ukraine. We've seen this before. They're trying to use every weapon that they have in their arsenal to intimidate Ukraine.
The warning comes as Russia's defense ministry said on Wednesday it may retaliate against Kyiv for an attack on a military base in the Rostov region in southern Russia. FBI Director Christopher Wray says he intends to step down next month when U.S. President Joe Biden leaves office. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Wray's announcement comes days after President-elect Trump said he'd nominate Kash Patel to take the job he gave Wray in 2017. They clashed from the start. During Wray's confirmation hearing, he split with Trump over the probe into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia.
I did not consider Director Mueller to be on a witch hunt.
The FBI ended up entangled in explosive probes of Trump that led to two indictments, and just days ago.
Well, I can't say I'm thrilled with him.
Trump on NBC's Meet the Press. He calls Wray's resignation a great day for America. Wray told the FBI workforce his resignation is the best way to avoid dragging the Bureau deeper into the fray. Sagar Magani, Washington.
New York police said on Wednesday that evidence from the killing of an American healthcare executive links the suspect to last week's shooting. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The gun found on the suspect in the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO matches shell casings found at the scene.
We were able to match that gun to the three shell casings that we found in Midtown at the scene of the homicide.
New York City's Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch made the announcement.
We're also able in our crime lab to match the person of interest fingerprints with fingerprints that we found on both the water bottle and the Kind bar near the scene of the homicide in Midtown.
Police had said earlier that they believe the gunman bought the items at a nearby coffee shop while waiting for his target. I'm Haya Panjwani.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Life is slowly returning to normal in Damascus.
Shops have reopened, and it appears to be business as usual, despite the dramatic collapse of the government only days ago.
What's next for the U.S.-Syria relationship?
We have to wait and see what they actually do in terms of trying to establish good governance.
And Donald Trump said he'd use the military to deport people. We take a look at his plan's feasibility and legality.
Whether he wants the military directly participating in law enforcement or providing more indirect support to a federal deportation operation.
Today is Thursday, December 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. VOA is on the ground in Damascus as businesses have reopened and many people are returning to work after the dramatic collapse of Syria's government. But as VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Damascus, some locals fear the war is not over, even as they celebrate new freedom.
In this market in central Damascus, shops have reopened and it appears to be business as usual, despite the dramatic collapse of the government only days ago. But people here say they are still deeply afraid. Last night and the night before, Israeli bombs pounded military targets all over this country. Besides bombs, they say, it is also not clear if the war is over or not. We're told the rebel victory over the Syrian government could usher in a new era of peace. Or it could also be another phase of the war. On the roads outside of Damascus, we see abandoned government checkpoints and military vehicles. Uniforms worn by government soldiers lie in the streets with stray bullets and other abandoned equipment. In the market, we are told one thing that has changed dramatically in recent days is their ability to speak freely without fear of retribution from the government. One man told us that he believes that if he said anything negative about the former government to foreign journalists, that he would simply disappear and never see his family again. Reporting from Damascus, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
As the dust is settling in Syria, the White House wants a transparent, Syrian-led process to form a new government after President Bashar Assad was ousted. Bejim Danmez Ersaz of VOA's Turkish service spoke with National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby outside the White House about the Biden administration's Syria policy after the Assad government fell.
Does the United States support or did it get prior notification with regard to their moves, strikes on the Golan Heights, and also pushing deeper into Syria?
I'm going to let the Israelis speak to their operations, and I'm not going to speculate about what they're doing. I would just tell you that they certainly have the right to self-defense. We recognize that they see threats across that border as things unfold in Syria, and they've taken some actions. So we're in constant communication with the Israelis about what they're doing, and that will continue.
Does the United States believe that this group has undergone an ideological transformation, and what will the administration be looking at while judging this group and its leader?
Well, on the first question, I think it's too soon to tell. Mr. Al-Julani is saying the right things about inclusiveness, about not being interested in persecuting either minorities or other groups. But I think, you know, we have to wait and see what they actually do in terms of trying to establish good governance. Whatever kind of governance comes out of this, we want to make sure it meets the aspirations of the Syrian people, that they have a vote and a voice in their future. So we want it to be a Syrian-led process, and the United States will continue to support that kind of process.
There is also a concern in Turkey regarding the potential of an independent Kurdish state in northern Syria. So how will the United States mitigate Turkey's concerns, and how does the administration balance that out?
They have legitimate concerns in terms of the safety and security of people inside Turkey. We're going to continue to, and this is, you know, I know right now Syria is kind of coming to the fore because of the news over the weekend, but it's not as if we haven't continually over the last 4 years had conversations with the Turks about their concerns along that border, and quite frankly sharing with them our concerns about what we're trying to do against ISIS, partnering with the Syrian Democratic Forces. So look, where those two levels of concerns overlap or maybe conflict, we have the ability and have executed the ability to have conversations with the Turks to try to sort all this out, and we'll do that.
The U.S. is apparently talking to Turkey for information on the whereabouts of Austin Tice. Can you share more on those talks, and is the United States using Turkey's unofficial communication channels with HDS and other rebel groups in Syria?
I won't get into the details of the discussions. I think you can understand why I wouldn't do that. We're still trying to get more context and information about Austin, where he is, what condition he might be in. We obviously talked to the Turks about this. That shouldn't come as any surprise. But we also talked to other counterparts in the region. Those conversations are ongoing. As the president said on Sunday, we want to see him back home with his family where he belongs. And we'll continue to have the level of engagement in the region to see if we can't bring about that outcome.
President-elect Trump has signaled a hands-off approach in Syria. What would be the danger of that for U.S. interests in the region?
Well, we'll let Mr. Trump speak to his plans when he comes into office. We believe there are two things keenly in America's national security interest. Number one, we've already talked about this, is the transition, peaceful transition to legitimate governance in Syria that is a Syrian-led process. The second thing that's very much in our national security interest is making sure that ISIS cannot regenerate the capabilities like it had in 2014 and cannot exploit the current uncertainty in Syria to their own advantage. And that is why we continue to take strikes against ISIS targets. That is why we continue to partner with the SDF. And that is why we're going to continue to make sure that the mechanisms are in place to be able to do that so that ISIS can't exploit ungoverned space or uncertainty in Syria to their own advantage.
Syria was an important playground for Iran and the Shia Crescent, and it has been broken now, as widely observed. Do you think Iran's ambitions over the Middle East are over?
I think only the Supreme Leader can answer that particular question. We know two things. As Iran wakes up and looks at the region, it's different. And their axis of resistance has been broken in many, many places. And we believe they realize that. And they, too, have been weakened as a military and as a capability, just in terms of, for instance, air defense. So the world's different for Iran as they wake up this morning, and that is in no small part due to the support that the United States has continued to provide Israel as they've gone after Hamas in particular, but also Hezbollah in Lebanon, and frankly, you know, our ability to help them defend themselves from attacks by Iran. That said, I can't tell you that as we look at the world today, that we see Iran giving up on their hegemonic ambitions in the region. They certainly are not as capable of executing those visions and that ambition, but I haven't seen anything that would indicate that that they're turning a blind eye to trying to pursue those kinds of ambitions.
Would the United States accept a hardline government under HTS that would contain Iran, as the leader of the group Jolani alluded in his speech?
What we want to see in terms of governance in Syria is governance that is seen as credible and legitimate, that is sustainable, that meets the aspirations of the Syrian people, and that is the result, the product of a Syrian-led process to get them to that point. I think it's too soon to know exactly how it's all going to unfold. I mean, this just really developed over the course of the weekend. So we're watching this real, real close. We are in touch with opposition and rebel groups, all of them, in one way or another. And we are having conversations with our counterparts in the region. The president spoke to King Abdullah yesterday. There'll be additional conversations and visits by key national security leaders in the coming days to make sure of that.
That was White House reporter Bejim Donmez Ersaz of VOA's Turkish service speaking with National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby.
The Biden administration said it would recognize and fully support a future Syrian government that results from an inclusive and transparent transition process. However, in 6 weeks, there'll be a new U.S. administration under Donald Trump, who has signaled a more hands-off approach. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Buttigieg-Usfara has that part of the story.
Syrians are still celebrating the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad, who has fled to Moscow. But the country's future is far from clear as regional powers scramble to secure their interests. From the south, Israel launched strikes to weaken what's left of the Iranian allies' military. In the north, Turkish-backed rebels seized territory, causing Syrian Kurds to flee. U.S. President Joe Biden has moved quickly, launching airstrikes on Islamic State group targets in Syria.
The United States will work with our partners and the stakeholders in Syria to help them seize an opportunity to manage the risk.
By contrast, President-elect Donald Trump has signaled a more hands-off approach.
It certainly seems like the world is going a little crazy right now.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebels who toppled Assad, is a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist group. Still, Trump wants the U.S. to stay out of the Syrian conflict. This is not our fight, he said on social media. Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick for intelligence chief, agreed.
He is fully committed, as he has said over and over, to bringing about an end to wars, demonstrating peace through strength, and putting the national security interests and the safety, security, and freedom of the American people first and foremost.
But with Assad gone, Trump may need to balance his non-interventionist stance with U.S. goals of protecting allies such as Israel and Jordan and avoiding the resurgence of terrorist groups such as Islamic State. Christopher O'Leary focuses on counterterrorism at the Sufan Group via Skype.
Reducing the access to chemical weapons, reducing the capabilities of known terrorist organizations in ungoverned space or in space where there's failed states, where nobody else can do it, I think is a very smart move. And I do think that is likely what President Trump will continue to do.
During his first term, Trump ordered strikes on the Assad regime in response to chemical weapons attacks, but focused more on defeating Islamic State. He ordered U.S. troops out of Syria in 2019, leaving a few hundred American soldiers to protect oil fields. He was criticized for abandoning allies. Following the withdrawal, Turkey launched offensives against Kurdish forces who had fought alongside American soldiers to destroy Islamic State in Syria. This time, Trump said, quote, "Let it play out. Do not get involved." But with so many U.S. interests in the region, that may be easier said than done. Patsy Widaguswara, VOA News, Washington.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
Attorneys for a man accused of attempting to assassinate then-candidate Trump in September has asked a federal judge to delay his trial until December of 2025. The public defenders representing Ryan Ruth have told the judge they need more time to review the evidence against him and decide whether to mount an insanity defense. Prosecutors agree that the current scheduled start of February is unrealistic, but they say a one-year delay is too long.
The 2034 Men's Soccer or Football World Cup will be held in Saudi Arabia. The decision was combined with approving the special plan for the 2030 World Cup. Spain, Portugal, and Morocco will co-host in a six-nation project with Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay, each getting one of the 104 games. The South American connection will mark the centenary of Uruguay hosting the first cup in 1930.
Haiti's main international airport reopened on Wednesday to commercial flights, this 1 month after gangs opened fire on planes. It was the second closing of the airport this year due to gang violence. Soldiers and police, along with a UN-backed mission, have boosted security in the area, and Haiti's government said a test flight was successful. However, there were no flights and no passengers Wednesday afternoon. Gangs now control about 85% of Haiti's capital. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Looking now at American politics, President-elect Trump's pledge to carry out the largest deportations in U.S. history raises questions about its feasibility and its legality. VOA's immigration correspondent Eleni Barros reports on how the U.S. military may be involved in those plans.
During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump said the worst of America's problems is illegal immigration.
We're going to have the largest deportation in history. I'm not proud to say that either, but it's a tough thing to do.
Since winning the election, Trump has shared a social media post saying he would declare a national emergency and deploy U.S. troops to help with those deportations. How the U.S. military might be used to carry out this promise of mass deportations is unclear, says New York University law professor Joseph Nunn.
It really depends on what exactly
that the president is contemplating in terms of how he wants to use the military, whether he wants the military directly participating in law enforcement or providing more indirect support to a federal deportation operation.
Incoming border czar Tom Holman is planning a more aggressive approach, emphasizing deportation operations and increased military involvement.
We have massive deportation operations, and we're going to try to find over 300,000 children that were released by this administration.
Holman cites a Homeland Security report showing over 32,000 unaccompanied minors missed court dates, while more than 290,000 received no notice. Immigration experts argue this does not necessarily mean that they're missing. Some may still be at their listed addresses.
Mass deportation is not the only option. Congress could instead create a new path to permanent legal status, allowing many people already living here to file an application, go through a background check, pay a fee, and get their papers in order.
The Senate Judiciary Committee this week discussed the challenges of mass deportations, with Democrats saying it could hurt the economy.
The fact is, there are millions of undocumented immigrants living in the United States today who are working in industries critical to our entire economy.
And Republicans emphasizing rule of law.
We will follow through on the orders of removal by immigration courts. And again, we will not accept lawlessness and criminality in the United States as the new normal.
Federal laws limit military involvement in civilian law enforcement without congressional approval. But non-emergency powers would allow the president to deploy troops to provide logistical support. Some experts say soldiers lack training for immigration enforcement.
Every service member who gets pulled into a domestic mass deportation operation is a service member who isn't doing their normal job and isn't fulfilling their ordinary national security role.
The state of Texas is offering the incoming Trump administration more than 550 hectares to build a processing and detention facility for what the state's land commissioner says will be, quote, the largest deportation of violent criminals in our nation's history. Aline Barros, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. intelligence warns that Russia is planning on using its new hypersonic missile on Ukraine again in the near future, and Russia says that Moscow is not ready to make concessions when it comes to Ukraine, and that President Vladimir Putin's own proposals on how to end the conflict need to be implemented. Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
Rescue work continues in Zaporizhia. The death toll from Tuesday's Russian missile strike has risen to 9, with more than 20 people injured. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova commented on Donald Trump's call for an immediate ceasefire and negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. Zakharova said that anyone who thought Russia would make concessions on Ukraine either had a short memory or did not have enough knowledge of the subject. She said President Putin's proposals on how to end the conflict need to be implemented. This includes Putin's desire for Ukraine not to join NATO and for Russia to get the entire territory of the four Ukrainian regions he has said are now part of Russia. According to the latest data, only the Luhansk region is almost completely under Russian control. The Donetsk region is mostly occupied, while the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions just partly. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky responded to Trump's comments by saying Kyiv eagerly desires peace. But for a just and long-term peace, effective security guarantees for Ukraine need to be implemented. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said on Wednesday that Ukraine's course of European integration is irreversible. He added that Russian President Vladimir Putin had not achieved a single war goal. Scholz also said a lot of private investment was needed in Ukraine's energy sector and that Germany has a great interest in investing in Ukraine. He emphasized that investing in Ukraine today and in the coming years is investing in a future EU member state. The Russian Defense Ministry said that Ukraine allegedly launched 6 attack-ups missiles at a military airfield in Taganrog in Rostov region. According to local Telegram channels, in addition to an aircraft repair facility, a military unit was also hit. According to local sources, ambulances and rescue vehicles, presumably with evacuees and wounded, had been passing by the base in the morning, and access to the entire territory of the military camp was closed. Also, the authorities of the Bryansk and Rostov regions of Russia reported drone and missile attacks by Ukrainian forces. Ukraine has only confirmed a strike on an oil depot in Bryansk. Meanwhile, Ukraine expects Russia to launch another Oreshnik intermediate trench ballistic missile. Vladimir Putin had previously publicly announced his intention to conduct the launch. U.S. intelligence confirms that Russia may use its new intermediate-range ballistic missile against Ukraine again soon, two U.S. officials said Wednesday. The Oreshnik missile was used for the first time last month during the Russian attack on the city of Dnipro. Experts say this step is seen more as an attempt at intimidation than as a game-changer in the war. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told U.S. lawmakers Wednesday that the Biden administration had been put in an impossible position ahead of the August 2021 U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. For years, Republicans on the House Foreign Affairs Committee have sought answers on the disastrous withdrawal that killed 13 U.S. service members and left thousands of Afghans stranded. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Taliban refugee minister Khalil Urrahman Haqqani killed in a suicide bombing in Afghanistan Wednesday, one of the most significant attacks on a Taliban leader since the group returned to power in August 2021. The disastrous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan allowed the Taliban back into power. House Republicans have been highly critical of the Biden administration's handling of that withdrawal. Michael McCaul is the House Foreign Affairs Committee chairman.
You had plenty of opportunity to plan for the inevitable collapse of Afghanistan. Instead, even with the warning bells sounding loudly, ringing loudly, you denied the imminent and dangerous threats to American interests, American citizens, and our decade-long Afghan partners.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken appeared before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Blinken said President Joe Biden inherited a deadline from former President Donald Trump, but no plan to meet it.
Had he not followed through on his predecessor's commitment, attacks on our forces and allies would have resumed, and the Taliban's assault on the country's major cities would have commenced. That would have required sending tens of thousands more U.S. forces back into Afghanistan to defend ourselves and prevent a Taliban takeover.
The incoming House Foreign Affairs Committee chairman, Republican Brian Mast, who lost both his legs fighting in Afghanistan, said the U.S. State Department has not been held to account for the withdrawal.
This place absolutely lives up to being a swamp. When we try to cover up the fact that 26 of your diplomats told you directly that if you continued down the path that you were going, that it was going to be a disaster. And we should not be covering that up.
But the top Democrat on the committee said Republicans had not followed through with any attempts to prevent those problems from happening again. Gregory Meeks is the top Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
The Republicans' so-called investigation has been nothing but a crude jewel aimed at partisan politics, in my opinion. To claim now that it's aimed at a real legislative purpose, when I don't see any tangible, they have not introduced a single bill. There's not been a bill at all introduced from this investigation.
13 U.S. service members and 170 Afghan civilians died in the Abbey Gate bombing in Kabul on August 26, 2021. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.